Welcome back to another episode of Straight to the Point. Today, I'm really, really excited to bring on somebody that I've known for years, not seen in years. And we're going to be going into kind of like, I guess, how we know each other and our background. But he is a former England cricketer. He's played lots and lots of cricket. He played with my dad growing up, which is how we know each other. He is the host of Inside the Mind of Champions podcast, top 10 management podcast, doing amazingly well with some interviews that completely blew my mind actually listening to them. I definitely recommend it. He is the founder of The Sporting Edge, which we're definitely going to talk about today. He is a sports and performance psychologist who's worked with some of the most amazing sports people around the world. He is also my former babysitter, Jeremy Snape. Welcome to the Straight to the Point podcast.
What a great introduction, Chris. Great to be here.
It's really, really good to have you on, mate. Really, really good. I mean, it'd been years since we caught up after, I think, we kind of got reconnected over on Clubhouse, I think. I think you were in a room, weren't you, at the time?
You were talking and explaining all about social media, and I was on there just trying to work out what this new platform was all about. And it was full of American voices, actually. And then yours came across, and I thought it was quite interesting. So I followed you as we do. We sort of follow down that train. And then when I connected, I think it was on Instagram, you'd said, oh, we know each other. And I was a bit spooked out by that, I have to say. And then when I saw your face close up and joined the dots, I could see that, yes, indeed, the last time I'd seen you was 20 years ago or something like that. I don't know. I dread to think.
It's crazy how it all kind of like reconnects itself. Like, it's such a small world with social media now. Like, I was only scrolling just through Facebook today and seeing some of the people which I hadn't seen in years from like school or back in the cricket days. We actually went to a Memorial Day for David Capel on the weekend, and just seeing some of the people there, it's like, it's amazing how some people don't change and some people you couldn't recognize for like a month of Sundays. It's absolutely crazy. But I mean, for the people that don't know who you are, Snapey, obviously I know who you are, but who are you? What have you done in the past, and what brings you to where you are today?
Wow. I was born in Stoke. I was a bit of a hyperactive kid. My dad sort of shoved me away to one of these training sessions at the local sports centre, which actually turned out to be the Staffordshire under-11s trial that we didn't know at the time. So I was asked to stay back. I think my dad thought I'd broken something and he was going to have to get his wallet out. But actually, I'd been picked for this under-11s team. That put me on a bit of a conveyor belt through the under-13s, under-15s, county kind of young junior cricket. And I ended up captaining England at 15 and started as a pro at 16 alongside your dad, which is what we just touched on. So my early apprenticeship, I guess, I stayed on at school, but I was doing part-time as a pro cricketer alongside Alan Lamb and Curtly Ambrose and some David Capel, as you mentioned, some incredible cricketers, and your dad, Paul Taylor, brilliant fast left arm, quick bowler. And that was my apprenticeship. We had lots of fun. We didn't win a lot of trophies, but it was certainly good fun. Lots of talent in that dressing room, but we didn't really convert. And I got offered the chance to move to Gloucestershire, went to play there with John Bracewell, Mark Alleyne, Jack Russell. And it was a really hard-working team, less talent for sure. But we ended up probably redefining one-day cricket at the time, winning, I think it was 5 or 6 trophies in 2 or 3 years. Incredible. You know, we won the double back-to-back at Lord's with the 2 one-day finals each year. It was incredible. So that really changed my career, I think. And then having the chance to play for England was fascinating. You know, touring all around the world and representing England was something I'm very proud of. But I guess through that, I learned that the highs and lows in my career were not necessarily down to my technique, because I'd stayed stable throughout. It was actually due to my mindset. And I became fascinated about how the top performers were thinking under pressure. And that led me to do a master's degree in sports psychology and then start working with some of the world's brilliant teams, England rugby with Eddie Jones, Premier League soccer, as you mentioned, working with South African cricket and some of those international teams. And, you know, it's been an absolute joy to work with them and you know, support them throughout. So yeah, that's where it's taken me. Sporting Edge is all about taking these insights from the world's best performers and translating that across into the business world as well. So consulting, keynote speaking, and our digital library and podcast, which you mentioned, we've basically filmed about 100 world-class thinkers and performers, whether it's neuroscientists, military leaders, elite coaches. And we use all of those videos as little two-minute snippets and coaching videos in our members club to inspire thousands of execs around the world and entrepreneurs. So it's, I guess I'm passionate about trying to break down high performance and simplify it for people. You know, I've been able to work with and interview some incredible people and get inside their minds. And then if I can break that down into practical strategies that we can all do, then I think that's, very fulfilling for me, because, you know, we all feel pressure in our working life. We all, want to be liked by everyone. We all want to be part of a high performing team. We all want to be good leaders, but there are definite proven tactics to accelerate that path and to make it more fun. I think, you know, I was probably too hard on myself in a lot of my career, and learning to go a bit easier on yourself and, you know, be a bit more resilient. Those are real great life tactics.
Yeah, totally. It completely fascinates me, kind of like your journey with where you've been, because obviously I was so young when we first met. I don't remember us meeting. I was that young, right? But obviously you hear like family conversations, and I saw you playing for Leicester with the T20 stuff. I then saw you, I remember watching a test match. I can't remember what test match it was, but you were on the balcony. And I remember going to mum and going, look, Snapey's on the balcony. We didn't know you did that. So I think it's amazing how things change. And you've obviously worked with some absolutely incredible people, and high performance is something that is spoken about a lot, I think, at the moment, in terms of how can we reach our potential? How can we perform to the highest level every single day that we show up? But I mean, everybody has a different definition of it. In terms of what you believe it is, what do you believe high performance actually means?
Well, I mean, I guess when we look at it on the global stage, we're looking at the apex, the very best performers in the world going head to head and trying to find one champion. That, you know, that's what that battle is, you know, the high performance battle. But, you know, I'd like to make it much more personal for all of us about that. I often think there's two versions of ourselves, you know, one that gets up a bit sluggish, maybe the alarm gets pressed on snooze, the duvet beats us first thing in the morning. We don't achieve everything we want to. We get a bit frustrated. We eat rubbish food. We have too much alcohol. You know, we don't sleep well as a result, and that spiral continues. And then the other version of us is a bit more focused, a bit more disciplined, has some goals, you know, and we stay true to those, and we feel proud and we feel confident based on the progress that we're making. So I think high performance is a choice. High performance takes, you know, incredible drive and discipline. And you're adapting all the time. I think one of the myths is that we see elite performers get to the top and we think that's just what they do. But actually, you know, they're constantly adapting and checking themselves, because of all the analysis in the current environment, there are, you know, cameras looking at you from every angle. So your rivals are exploiting your weaknesses and stopping your strength. So you've got to keep wriggling out and finding a new way to be successful. And I played professional cricket for 19 years, and I was probably 19 different cricketers as a result of that. And I think, you know, that going into my entrepreneurial career, setting up Sporting Edge, that's the same. You know, you lose clients, you build a new product, the market changes, the disruption we've seen over the last, you know, couple of years with the pandemic. You've got to be constantly checking your, you know, route to market and your strengths and innovating all the time. And I think that's a mindset, and that's definitely what we see in the high performers.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think when I look at the term, I think it is just looking at what, I guess, the best of the best do, however you define the best of the best in whatever arena it is. Like, I always look at some of the most top performing sports people, because that was what I wanted to be. Cricket was what I wanted to play. I went through, and it's why I love this subject altogether, right? Because I went through, when I was around about 18, I'd just taken wickets against Nottinghamshire for the academy, and then I had a double stress fracture in my back, so it completely put me out for around about 18 months, and I basically really struggled to bowl again. So I went through a bit of a turmoil, and it's where I found, I guess, the love for psychology and like self-improvement and trying to be self-aware, which I think has been when I look back at how I've done what I've done, and I've still gotten nowhere near close to where I want to get to. It's the self-awareness thing that's been probably one of the biggest traits. But I am interested with like some of the common traits that you see throughout your own career and also with the people that you work with. Are there common traits that these top performers, these high performers have, which enable them to reach such high levels?
Without a doubt. I mean, my personal story is that I think a big catalyst for me was failing my 11 plus. My brother went to a private school and it was pretty much expected that I would just pass this exam and get through and join the lift rota with local parents and wear my brother's old uniform kind of thing. That was the plan. And then anyway, of all the papers, I sort of failed one of them and this letter came through the letterbox and landed on the door. And this, you know, wonderful moment of the family sitting around on the sofas, you know, unveiling this letter turned to tears all round and an absolute moment of shame for me, you know, and that was really painful. And although I probably toughed it out at the time, I remember thinking, I'm not going to let anyone else down again like that. That was too much. And I had this ferocious work ethic. I think, you know, that was a huge part of me then going on. And whenever I was practicing and training, I'd be the first in and last out. I'm not sure that was, you know, as you play more, you know, through the 19 years, you learn that that's not actually the key. Being smart about it is more, but definitely in those early years, it helped me to feel prepared that I was ready for combat if I'd worked hard. But I think on a broader sense with the research I've done for our content and our video libraries and interviews, I think there are sort of two or three key attributes that come through. First of all, this drive and this ability to set these inspirational and aspirational goals. And the Olympians and the world champions, it's almost like they're able to visualize it in Technicolor and high definition. They don't just say, oh, I want to be a champion. They imagine what it'll feel like. They imagine what people will be writing about them. They imagine what the relationships and the choices they'll have in their life from that position on top of the podium. And that's very different because that you know, immersing yourself in that identity, if you like, makes you want to make that shift even more. Then they've got the ability to break those goals down into a game plan. So you can't just say, I want to be a, you know, an NBA basketball and sit on the sofa, you know, eating burgers. So that ability to create a gold medal plan, I think, is really important. So, you know, we might find that athletes are breaking their mental, physical, tactical, technical elements of the goal down further. So the physical elements become strength and power and flexibility. And then the power breaks down again into a certain series of weight training sessions. And then that's where the discipline comes in and the routines, because it's one thing being given a plan or making your own plan, but then having that daily discipline to stick to those gold medal habits, that's a completely different thing altogether. So I think, you know, in the same with your world, that discipline of a number of posts, even when you don't like feel like doing it, the volume of you know, content that you need to put out and having that discipline to stick onto that brand messaging, that's exactly like an Olympian having to do the, you know, 88th and 89th and 90th press up and not quitting after 60 because they feel a bit tired. So I think there's that discipline to execute with brilliant basics. That's something that defines people. And usually there's a fire in the belly that makes people want to go to that painful point where they just do that more than anyone else. And then I think, as you mentioned, that self-awareness and ability to adapt is definitely, if you're going to be successful in anything for a decade, you won't be the same person at the end as you started. So, you know, that growth mindset, that hunger to learn, and that calls for a balance between humility that says, well, you know, I'm not sure I'm quite doing this as well as I could do. I could be better than this, but also that confidence and courage to say, I'm going to take a risk here. I'm going to try this new thing. I'm going to learn this new skill. I'm going to reach out to this person. I'm going to, you know, join this new club. I'm going to take a risk here and do something to change my environment. And that combination of those three things of drive, discipline, and adaptability and learning are probably the key, you know, factors, I think.
Yeah, I was listening just this morning, actually, to an interview that Virat Kohli did. And for those of you that don't know who Virat Kohli is, he's probably one of the best. He is probably the best at this current point, best batsman in the world in all three cricket formats. And he's very similar to mindset wise to what I would say like Cristiano Ronaldo's like in the footballing world. And he was saying that I think he was going through a tough period in 2017 where he came over to England, got completely worked over. And a couple of his teammates messaged him and were just like, look, we know you're going through a tough period. All the best in the world go through a tough period. And his response back was, oh, don't worry about me. Come back to me in 2 months' time. And in 2 months' time, he just completely dominated Australia, scoring four back-to-back hundreds. And I think it's that resilience and mindset of, I will return and I will be the best again, that continuous fight is something that I definitely see in him and also in some of the other top performers. I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo, for one of them, to stay at the top of his game for 15 years or however long it's been, you've got to be completely insane to be able to do it in reality, because it's just such a high level of psychological control and also resilience to be able to go through it. I mean, in terms of performing at that level for that sustained amount of time, obviously purpose is big, but I mean, what are your thoughts on resilience as well in terms of always trying to battle back even when things get tough? Is that something that you see in some of these top performers as well?
Yeah, without a doubt, resilience. And that, you know, I guess part of that adaptability is trying to find the spots where you're not going to get exposed. So that's a bit more proactive. But, you know, without doubt, you're going to get injuries. You're going to have setbacks. You're going to be dropped. You're going to fall out with coaches. You know, you're going to get missed tournaments, whatever it is. And I think those examples that you've just given, as you rise, you know, in your profile and fame, you start to hear a lot of very positive noise and praise that can say, you know, this guy's the best player we've seen. This guy's going to be the best ever, whatever it might be. And actually that can weaken you if you listen to that too much. So I think everybody needs that, you know, pumping your tires up and making you feel great, you know, at some point when you're feeling low. But I think what the elite performers that really transcend their sport, so, you know, Lewis Hamilton, Roger Federer, those kind of people, Ronaldo, as you say, Virat, you know, what they're doing is they're actually falling in love with the process of mastery. So how good can I be? So for Roger Federer, he's not as athletic as he used to be, but tactically and strategically, he's developing more and more wisdom that can still make him competitive. So he's running his own race as his body matures and, you know, ages, his brain and tactics are adapting. So he's staying at the top. So I think we all become, especially in the social media and marketing world, we become very focused on what everyone else thinks of us. So there's a bit of a conflict here that the world's elite performers actually focus on their own race and their own mastery. And their focus is on daily improvement rather than, of course, the big trophies help and the big medals and that kind of stuff. They sort of go along the sort of journey. But I think the drive comes from continual improvement. So, you know, resilience is absolutely critical. You're right.
I think, like I say, what fascinates me is that you've got, especially in sport and business, actually, and a lot of people talk about the pinnacle, like the top half, like the top people in their industry. But people don't really talk about the middle. You know, the people that are like battling away for years and years and years. Okay, take cricket, playing county cricket all the time. The footballers that like are in Premier League, maybe Championship football, that are keep going and going and going. They're not aiming to be the best, but they're aiming to be the best versions of them that they can be. And I remember hearing you talk about purpose in a lot of the stuff that you do. And that's the thing that drives people. How do you think these people that you've experienced and worked with have gone about finding purpose? Because it's something that's so easy to say, like go and find your why, like go and think about. But is there like a process that people can go through to be able to identify what that purpose might be?
Well, it's a great question. And I think obviously Simon Sinek's work has been, you know, stellar in terms of its popularity, but it's not particularly tangible, as you say, you know, go and find your why and you know, start with why, all that sort of stuff. You know, it's not straightforward. You know, some of the people I've been lucky enough to meet, you know, one example, which is remarkable, is two of the guys that were in prison with Nelson Mandela. So in one of my podcasts, I interviewed, you know, them, Ahmed Kathrada and Dennis Goldberg. And basically, they were involved in the ANC to try and overthrow the apartheid era in South Africa. And these two guys, there wasn't enough on them to get them to prison, really. But they stood by Nelson Mandela and went to prison for life for 26 years because they wanted to protect him. So imagine being caught for being protesting about something and not having to go to prison, you individually, but because you believed so passionately in the cause and the leader needed to be protected by more, you know, if he was on his own, he'd get exposed and probably wouldn't come out of prison. But eight of them went to prison around Nelson Mandela and stayed with him for 26 years. And their purpose to overthrow the apartheid era was so powerful that it gave them individual strength when they were put through the adversity and isolation and, you know, whatever other treatment they had during that time. And it allowed them to stay strong as a team of eight. So we talk about high performing teams. Imagine that being, you know, isolated and, you know, horrible things done to you for 26 years and you stay strong and never one of you breaks. That's purpose. So Ahmed Kathrada in one of the podcasts talks about that and his optimism that if they stayed strong together for another day, for another week, for another month, they could improve the situation and get free and change South Africa, which of course they did. So I think there's a huge part of it is finding something that you're passionate about, but there's a beautiful Japanese, it's a bit like a Venn diagram with loads of beautiful circles. If you search ikigai on the internet, you'll see it. And it basically these overlapping circles of trying to work out for an individual what it is. And it's a combination of what you love to do, so your favorite things in the world, what you're good at, your personal strengths, what the world needs, what there's a demand for, and also what you can get paid for. And those four circles overlap. And in the center, in the sort of bullseye of those four circles, that's the perfect position for you. That's where you should be in your element because it's something that you're passionate about. It's something that you know, is a natural strength for you. It's something that is making an impact in the world and it's something that you can earn a living from. And I think we often see purpose as something that's completely outside of our commercial framework. It's a hobby or it's a, you know, a charity event or whatever it might be, but actually trying to move it into that commercial space is a really nice framework. And the other option, which has definitely been accelerated through the pandemic, is that we might see people saying, well, actually, I'm going to work 3 days a week. Yeah. And I'm going to work 3 days a week and I'm going to absolutely blast it in this particular area to give me just enough money to pay my bills and do what I want to do. And then my 2 days a week are for my mental health and passion and purpose. They are the things that I'm going to get and do. So, you know, I may be working in an organization that I'm not really in love with, but I get paid a good salary and I can get my head down and work 3 days and blast it. And then my Thursday and Friday are my passion project, my purpose. I work for a charity, and that balance of, you know, commercial ruthlessness and purpose and charity, you know, might be a different combination rather than trying to say, I've got to find this one thing that I can, you know, get paid for and I love. It's a tough ask sometimes.
I think that's such a cool way of being. I've heard of Ikigai, but I've never actually looked into it in too much detail. So I'm definitely going to, because for me, it's so practical and definitely something that makes logical sense. And I think that talk of purpose links nicely into kind of a subject that I'd love to go in a bit deeper on, because people look into the world of professional sport and also like the top business people ever. And they look at this, and I definitely did when I was growing up, at this amazing lifestyle, glorious life that they live. But people go through tough periods, right? And they go, especially in careers in sport where they're not playing particularly well. And in business, the same thing, where they're not performing as well as they need to, maybe going through a tough time revenue-wise or staff-wise. And I know that you've dealt with and worked with some incredible teams in the past, and they must have been going through some pretty dark periods in what they've been going through. I mean, how do you tend to look at those challenging times? How do you look to help people work through those periods when things don't look particularly bright for them and they're going through a darker period? How do people work through that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the salesperson that's, you know, not sold in the last 2 months, or the batsman that's not scored runs in the last month, you know, it's a tough place to be, and you can very quickly cannibalize your own confidence if you're not careful. So I think, you know, one thing is the outcome and the selection and winning and what everyone thinks of as that's that sort of external validation and judgment. The other thing is, did I actually do what I said I was going to do? Did I stick to the process? Because if we don't stick to the process and the basics of what we said were going to help us be a good performer, we've got no chance of winning anyway. But the problem is we get so carried away with what everyone else thinks, and we haven't scored, or we haven't won, or we haven't sold. So we panic and we start doing different things. So I think if ever I'm working with a football team or a cricketer or whatever, a business person, it would always be, tell me about a time when you were playing at your best. And they will say, I was preparing like this. I was doing these drills. I came into the game with this mindset, and I just looked to bat for a period of time and get myself in, or whatever it might be. Or I just focused on building a great relationship with my clients and trying to help them rather than sell my stuff. Okay, that's really interesting. What are you doing now in this slump? Oh, I'm just trying to sell as soon as I got on the call because I'm desperate. I haven't sold. My boss has told me I've got to sell. Or I'm just trying to hit the first ball out of the park for six because I haven't scored runs for months. So I'm just trying to get away. You know, and obviously that's ridiculous. You know, you in your darkest and lowest point, you're trying to take on the highest risk behavior. So our brain plays silly tricks on us sometimes. And I think some you've just got to go back to those very basic strategies that my job is to do this today. And you hold yourself account, forget what everyone else is saying, forget what the media say, forget what the outcome is, the runs, the sales. Have I built a good relationship with my clients? Have I tried to help them? Am I listening to them? Am I adapting what I'm offering to what they need? If all those things happen, then you will start selling stuff. Otherwise, you've got a bad product and you start with another product or you move companies or whatever. But you know, by trying risky things and silly things, you know, it's never going to work. So brilliant basics, going back to your strengths, going back in your timeline to what you've done in the past. You know, and I've worked with footballers, for example, that weren't strikers, that weren't scoring. And we created a short video to their favorite soundtrack with highlights of them scoring loads of goals and got them to voice over and say, oh, look at my position. I'm looking for the ball, or look at the attacking line, or I'm getting into space and look at my body language. And of course, if you keep watching those things and immersing yourself in when you were doing it well, you can see you're not doing it now when you're in a slump. So it's just about getting back there as soon as you can.
I love that. And one of the things that you mentioned there was process. Now, one of the things that I see in business a lot and also in sport are people tinkering with things all the time. Just recently, I'm going to keep talking about cricket because it's the one thing that I'm watching so much of at the moment. But they were talking just on the test match this morning about some of like the batting positions our opening batsmen get into. And how we've just got the most awkward techniques going right now. People are always chopping and changing their process to try and improve and get better. Do you think, and I guess it's a bit of a leading question, but there is a balance to remaining on your current process and then identifying the points at which you need to make a change in the process to improve? And is that just a trial and error thing, or is there some calculated ways in which you've been able to work with people in the past, both in the corporate world and also in the sports world, to be able to get that right balance of improvement on process?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's a difficult one to explain. But I think, you know, you either take time out of what you're doing and you completely reinvent yourself. That's one way of doing it. And obviously for an athlete, that's unlearning all the muscle memory that you've had before doing it a certain way and trying to do it a different way. That can be tough. Or what happens more often is you're actually in competition. You've still got to deliver in the short term, but you're trying to adapt to a different style of play. So that might be like a 3 or a 6 month goal. And that's where you might look at that 80-20 principle of, okay, I'm going to stick with my 80 of what I'm doing at the moment, but 20% of my focus is going to be on this innovation. And it's a bit like you've got this super tanker. One of the leadership experts that we've interviewed talks about innovation in this sense, that if you're a big corporate, you're a super tanker that can't change direction very easily. But you also need, if you're going to be adaptable, to put the speedboats out. They're much more agile. They can, you know, swing round, adventure, go and explore different areas and come back and give back information. And we see this with the big banks, for example, investing in fintech startups, and they might take some of these clever credit card or Apple Pay or these kind of ideas and bring it into their main business once it's been incubated there. It's the same for us as individuals. Maybe we have a certain job at the moment, but we've got a side hustle, which is 20%, and we're investing more and more time and effort into that over time, so that then it becomes 60-40, 50-50, at 70-30, and 100% the other way. So I think this gradual adaptation is probably more likely. But again, it's a strategic plan that you've disciplined yourself to spend a certain amount of time. For example, you might say, 4 days of the week, I'm going to do this core business. 1 day of the week, I'm going to be innovating and setting up my new project or product. And that's a good way to discipline yourself about allocating the time and resource into innovation.
Yeah, I think throughout the pandemic, we've seen lots of businesses having to emergency innovate, right? And it's something that we talk about a lot inside our group of companies with what we're doing at this current point, because if we're doing too much innovation, we can forget the core principles and core process of what we're doing, and we can get lost in trying to change something which, quite frankly, most likely doesn't need to be changed. And on the other side of things, we're dedicating that time to having to look in the future and go, okay, well, let's take a look at these social media platforms. Which ones are the ones which we need to make sure that we're prioritizing to get the best result for a client? But then also, in 5 to 10 years' time, where do we think time's going to go? So I agree completely that 70-30, 80-20, 90-10 principle, however people really want to look at it. I think for me, it comes down to, and this is something that I've experienced a lot, is understanding your foundations of what's enabled you to get to where you've got to. And then always taking inspiration for what you hear and what you see other companies doing, but not taking it for granted that if it's worked for them, that it's automatically going to work for you. Having a bit of an inkling to go, you know what, let's test it. But also having, I guess, those controls in place to be able to measure whether it's been a successful change or a negative change. I see a lot of businesses at the moment like testing stuff for the sake of testing it, but then don't have those quantifiable measures in place to be able to work out what success even looks like for them. So yeah, I find it really, really fascinating. And we see it a lot in leadership teams as well at this point, especially in the larger organizations that we work with. And we see it actually in startups in the same way, where they're making leadership decisions for their business with no actual data beneath them. They're doing it because they've heard somebody talk about an idea that might work. And I know that you've had some great experience with leadership teams in corporate businesses, but also within the sports teams. And I was actually listening to the podcast that you did around the Rajasthan Royals back in 2008, I think it was. And there's such a group of strong personalities in that team from looking back at it. I mean, within that group, I'd love to know, like, what do you think made up the success of having, one, all of those egos and all of that talent in the team? But then sometimes you see, like, I mean, England's football team, for instance, when we had Gerrard, Lampard, Beckham, they're amazing team, like players on paper, but never quite gelled as a team together. With Rajasthan Royals and these IPL teams, they seem to. I mean, with that one in particular, what did you believe their success was down to?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, the Rajasthan, the IPL was a brand new tournament. It's a bit like the 100 now. There was no heritage of any of the teams. It was just an idea from the billionaires of India. And they threw all the best players into an auction and started throwing cash at it, basically. So players that had been earning, I don't know, £200,000-£300,000 a year were now getting $700,000-$800,000, $1.2 million for 8 weeks tournament. So it was a completely different thing. And of course, now we've got the world's best individual talent trying to come together into these brand new teams. So I was working with Rajasthan. We had blue kit. We were the Rajasthan Royals. The red kit was Delhi Daredevils. The black kit was the Calcutta Knight Riders. You know, these, you know, freakish names, and everyone looked like Flash Gordon coming out to play cricket. So we had to try and find something that made a lot of the focus, and you see this in TV and broadcast and social media, we're trying to make individual icons. So we're trying to talk about Sachin Tendulkar versus Shane Warne because they are these massive mythical figures on this huge amount of money. What we did, I guess, two things. One was we saw our Indian youngsters, actually, because there were five Indian youngsters, I think, in each of the teams that you had to play. So actually, the competitive advantage was not Shane Warne versus Sachin Tendulkar. It was our five youngsters against their five youngsters. So we had to make our youngsters feel more courageous, more innovative and more combative than the opposition. So that was a piece of work. We found this sort of David and Goliath story that was part of the Rajasthan folklore, basically. And this young boy called Rana Pratap had killed the, enemy king. And this was a really proud story for them. So we had this little award that Warney would present to say who was the bravest of our young players. And they loved that. So our young players definitely out-competed the opposition, and Ravindra Jadeja from the current Indian team was in that, and he was one of those players. And then the other thing, I guess, is when you're bringing a diverse group of people together, and this is very relevant for people working globally or people working in sort of dispersed teams with everyone at home, is we need a purpose and an identity that is bigger than us as individuals, because if we've just got big egos bashing against each other, it's basically going to be me versus you in this discussion. But what we have to do is create this sense of us striving for this. So it has to be about how can we change the client's life? How can we achieve this for the business? And you and I are both individuals trying to contribute to that. We can't do it on our own. We can't deliver this whole impact on our own. And that's where purpose drills down into individual level work. And for in Rajasthan, that was about trying to understand that we were the cheapest team actually in the IPL. And we were this underdog sort of tag. So we spoke to each of the players about when they'd been an underdog and when they fought to defend their word and their territory and, their sort of principles. And each individual actually had been an underdog at some point in their life. And whether they were Shane Warne or whoever, they all shared that story around the sort of dinner table at night. And that made us feel like we were the underdogs trying to prove people wrong. And that story galvanized all the individual egos around one central purpose. And that's what was a big part of building that culture. Clearly, the players played incredibly well, but we won all of our home games and won the final in a tense final. So I think storytelling and identity are critical to building, strong teams.
I love that. And you mentioned the word culture, which is another word that is thrown around in business. Now, the amount of conversations I've had around our corporate culture with what we're building at this point is the list is just endless. I mean, in terms of building cultures in organizations, are there, as well as the stuff that you've just mentioned there, are there specific areas that you tend to look at as a group to be able to develop a strong, high-performing culture within startups, SMEs, corporates? Is there something that you kind of work through with in regards to that?
Well, yeah, and I think, again, we sort of, if you walk into a team, if you walk into an office, you can smell the culture. Yeah. And it either smells like perfume or like something very different. You can sense that in the atmosphere. But that's a result of all the touch points that those performers have experienced through time. So another way to look at it is, what are the key touch points almost in the life cycle of a performer coming through that team? So when they hear about the team in the media, what do they hear and what do they feel? A bit like a brand, what are the three words that come to your mind when you hear British Airways versus Virgin Atlantic? You'll have three very different words that define that brand. That's the promise of an experience, and teams have that as well. So what do you sniff out and what do you smell in that team culture? Is it sort of lazy backbiting politics, or is it clear, resilient trust? Those are three key things. So that kind of thing happens. But then if we look at the life cycle, we've got things like first day at work. First day at work, your business is different to first day at work. My business is different to first day at work at the All Blacks and different to HSBC or whatever. So what does that touch point look like? How do we get that sense of belonging? What heritage and story are people hearing and weaving their life and ambitions into it so that they feel like they can get off to a fast start and it makes them feel like they're at home? When there's disciplinary issues, what does the culture do? Do we turn our back and pretend it hasn't happened? Do we shout in front of everyone? Do we take people aside and give them a warning? Or do we fine them because there's a set of 10 commandments that you just don't do that in our business? As people mature and celebrate success, how do we do that? Do we have an all-night, you know, party and get absolutely lashed? Do we have a financial reward? Do we have a huddle where everyone praises them? You know, these touch points are ultimately what define the culture. And then, of course, we've got the day-to-day workings and how people are trusted and empowered and what the leadership is doing to create that atmosphere and that scent or stench in the sort of cultural environment, if you follow that analogy.
Definitely. I think Toto Wolff, I listened to something with him the other day when he was on the F1 and being interviewed, and how when he walked into Mercedes, he looked at it, there was like rubbish on the floor. It just didn't feel right. And he went, this isn't a Mercedes office. And he went up and he cleaned it himself and he set the standards himself. And from that point, everything started to change for the Mercedes F1 team. One of my friends works for them now, and it just says that everything now is kind of built. So when Toto walks in, it's born. This is a Mercedes environment. They're all bought into that culture. I think it's such a cool example of someone that can lead that way. And he, I think, speaking about one, setting values, and how most businesses set values. I say most, a proportion of businesses set values for the sake of setting them, but don't actually embed them in their organization. Whereas he is like the pinnacle of, these are our values. We live or die by these values. That is exactly what we work on. And I think that explains it very, very well in that regard. And some of the best teams ever, some of the best businesses ever, that's what they're built on, is those set of rules and principles that whenever you walk in, whether you meet the owner or whether you meet the cleaner or you meet the people that are top versus the people that are just starting out, everyone's working towards that same mission, which I find valuable. I have some fun questions to kind of finish off on, which I always like to throw in as a bit of a curveball with it. But we've spoken a lot about like different strategies, tactics and advice that we've both received over the period of what we've been doing. What would be the advice that you'd give the 18-year-old version of you if you could go back?
Well, I was having plenty of fun, so I wouldn't say have more fun. What I would say is, you're good enough. You know, you can be good enough. Just go easy on yourself. I was probably too hard on myself, beat myself up and didn't back myself enough. I think that'd probably be it. So, you know, you'll get it if you grasp it lightly rather than trying to strangle the life out of every training session and every match. I probably that would be the advice.
Love it. And then let's go the other way. The 70-year-old version of you, what advice do you think he'd give you now?
Write a book.
There you go. I love that. What would the book be about?
Well, I mean, I've been very lucky to interview 100 amazing people. The podcast is a version of it, I guess, you know, trying to showcase how all of those different insights and lives can help all of us. But I think writing it into a book would be, you know, take it to another level.
Amazing. Most inspirational person that you've interviewed? Put you on the spot there, because they're all so good.
That's a good one. To be honest, I think those guys that were in prison with Nelson Mandela will take some beating. I think when you talk about discipline and purpose and, you know, fighting for a cause that's bigger than you, that was incredible. But, you know, obviously playing against Sachin Tendulkar and these kind of people as well, and met Mark Cavendish, the cyclist, he was incredible. Pep Guardiola and Sir Alex Ferguson, you know, I've been so lucky to meet them and try and pick their brains. And, you know, each one of them has made an impact on me for sure.
I love that. And if you were going to pass on, I guess, the best bit of advice you've ever received, if you could pinpoint one, what would that be?
Well, I think in the current context, it's stay open-minded, you know, stay open-minded and curious about, you know, what what could happen. And I guess you sort of learn and fail forwards towards that new goal. You know, none of us really know what's going to happen. That the last 2 years has taught us that. So stay open-minded and yeah, keep working hard and adapting.
And with that being said, what is next for Jeremy Snape and the Sporting Edge? What are you working towards? What is your purpose at this current point?
Well, we've just launched our members club, which is giving everybody, entrepreneurs, teachers, students, execs, sports coaches, access to all of our interviews. Every one of our interviews is split down into 2-minute videos, and we've got a little toolkit that sits alongside it. So it's really to help more people to get access to that. So, if anyone wants to come to sportingedge.com and join our members club, then if you add in podcast 50, there's a 50% discount on the first month to that. And I guess for me, the next stage is just to keep interviewing amazing people and putting it back into that central place so that everyone can be inspired themselves.
Yeah, I can definitely vouch for it. I had a look around it when we were having a conversation the other day, and I didn't realize how valuable it was, if I'll be totally upfront, like in terms of the people that you've got in there, the different interviews. There's so many like incredible high performing people giving you practical advice on so many different subjects, and how you can search for those specific subjects and it picks you out a library of all the different clips. For me, it's so valuable as a business owner, not just someone who loves sport and loves these people and pretty much treats it just as an autobiography of Netflix for me, really, in terms of what's going on. Like, I love a documentary, but just in terms of value of team building, culture, leadership, performance, mind, it's just all of it's encompassing. So yeah, no, I'll make sure I'll link it in the show notes for everybody, because it's definitely worth checking out. It's a really, really cool resource. And I know you're building a nice community with it, with all different kinds of people that are a part of it. But I mean, where can people get in touch with you, Snape, if they want to, where's the best place to get in touch?
Well, Twitter is at the Sporting Edge, LinkedIn, Jeremy Snape, and sportingedge.com. And you've mentioned the podcast a few times, which is probably a great place to start hoovering up the insights. And that's Inside the Mind of Champions.
Amazing. I'll make sure to link it all in the show notes for anyone that's listening. So it's been a pleasure to have you on, mate. It's fascinating listening and to all the different nuggets and knowledge that you've had and built up over time. And look forward to speaking really soon.
Good stuff. Good luck, Chris.
Cheers, buddy.